Feed me, of course. That's part of it. You gotta feed me. You gotta hang out with me. And I love the fact that you're still faithful. That's what means so much. You're steady and faithful to the Lord. Faces that both of you, for the most part, I saw 20 years. It's been 20 years since we came here. We came here in July of 98. So a lot of time has gone by, a lot of changes, and a lot of people who were here once among us who are now before the Lord, well, you're still faithful. And I love the Lord, friends, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate this opportunity, and I appreciate all you've done for me over the years. And the Lord knows what I mean by that. And I just, I'm glad to be here. Steph's going to be here, Lord willing, she and Madison tomorrow. She was going to be here tonight, but Micah came in. He's at Florida College this year. Our youngest is, he was born here while we were here. But he's on fall break, and so he's flying back today, which is why she stayed around. And then she just found out this morning that his flight was delayed 6 hours, so she has to stick around for that. And so she'll be here for tomorrow for the rest of the time we have together. So good to be with the Hathaways, and I know that you all have heard good things so far. I know you all have a good, promising future together. And I'm just grateful that they're here with you and vice versa. I have called an audible. I was asked to submit sermon titles for the flyer, so I did that. And I'm going to try and stay true to form for the rest of the meeting. But I want to share something with you that I've shared with people in various places, and it's always encouraging for me to think on these things. So for a few minutes, I want us to think about these things this morning. And it's based on the fact and the concept of a memorial. And I don't think any of us are unfamiliar with that. We all understand what a memorial is, and how we set aside certain times or certain places to think about our blessings, or to think about our fortunes, or to think about some sacrifices, really, that people made to bless us. And so that's the intent of a memorial, is to reflect back on those sacrifices, or at least the significance of some events. And when you think about memorials, obviously we are gathered today for a very special memorial. That's why we are gathered on Sunday, the Lord's Day, to gather to do something that the Bible calls the Lord's Supper. And in fact, it has various names for this memorial, that it's also the breaking of bread, it's communion, it is called the cup of the Lord, and it is called the Lord's table. And I can give you copies of these charts, and you don't feel like you have to write everything down. But we gather for this memorial, and it's something that's unlike anything else that we do. And it's unlike any other type of memorial that we gather to remember. And so, when we think about the Lord's Supper, you know, why do we take the Lord's Supper? What does God want us to think about? What does He want us to meditate on? And what does He want us to accomplish? Because every memorial has a purpose. So what's His purpose? What's His intent in having us gather every 7 days? I mean, the first day of the week, He says, you need to stop what you're doing, you need to think about this. Every week. And so, before we begin our week, we engage in this reflection. Alright, so what does that mean? Why would He have us to do this? What does He want us to accomplish? And so we take the Lord's Supper, number one, because Jesus tells us to do this. He has commanded us to do this. We see the setting for the foundation of the Lord's Supper. The night before Jesus was betrayed, the night before He was killed. And it says in Matthew chapter 26 that He was gathered at this time with His disciples. And it says on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus and said to Him, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? Alright, so that's why they were gathered. They were gathered together to take the Passover. So what does that mean? What was the Passover? Well, for 1400 years, God would have His people, the Jews, stop every year and think about something. And what was that? What did the Passover cause them to think about?
Well, it was going back to the time when they as a people, right, were in bondage. And they could not deliver themselves. And so God sent Moses in, and through these series of plagues and miracles, he was able to lead the people out. And they left in such a hurry, in such a haste, that God told them, every year I want you to stop and you think about it. I want you to have unleavened bread, 7 days of unleavened bread, because you didn't have time for the leaven to mature. And I want you to think about how you could not deliver yourselves, and I had to come in and do that. And that it was caused by the blood of the Lamb. That the night that God delivered Israel from bondage, he sent one final plague in, and that plague was that every firstborn of animal and people is going to be killed. Except the families that have the blood of the Lamb put on the lintel of the doorpost. And so if you take this lamb and you sacrifice and put the blood at the doorway, then the angel of death that was coming in that night would pass over your house and spare your death. Well, that's exactly what happened. They slaughtered the lamb, they put the blood, and those who had the blood, they were spared death. They passed over their house. And so every year, God would have his people to stop and eat no leaven for 7 days, thinking about this time, and to jumpstart that feast, he had them do the Passover, thinking about this great deliverance. Well, Jesus is gathered, as every good Jew would do. They would gather, and he's gathered with his disciples, and they're doing this as Jews. Well, in the midst of them taking this memorial service, it says that as they were eating, Jesus took bread, unleavened bread also, blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which was shed for many for the remission of sins." Now this is totally different. Because for years, that bread would represent haste, right? It would represent the speediness in which they had to leave. And the urgency in their departure. And so now Jesus says, "Okay, we're going to do something different. We're going to have a new covenant. And I want this bread to be symbolic of what? Symbolic of my body that I'm sacrificing for you. And I want you to take this fruit of the vine, and I want you to drink this fruit of the vine, but I want you to think about not the lamb's blood of the literal lamb from the sacrifice, but now I want you to think about my blood." And how the parallel obviously is that just like Israel could not deliver themselves from Egyptian bondage, so we could not deliver ourselves from the spiritual consequences of sin, the death, and that a lamb was needed, and Jesus, of course, is the fulfillment of that lamb, and how he is able to deliver us from this death and give us life. And he's able, as it even says in Romans 5, God is able to pass over us because of our sins being redeemed by. And so Jesus takes these emblems and he initiates a new thought. He creates a new memorial for these people to consider. And of course, the gist of it is we reflect on that sacrifice. We think about the effort he put forth to provide us with the remission of sins. And there was a great effort put forth. He was just starting. I mean, yes, he's gathered there with his disciples. But his pain is just about to begin. I mean, because he was about to be betrayed and arrested and beaten and all those horrible things. And he knew this was coming. And in fact, in Luke chapter 22, it talks about how he was well aware of the pain he was about to experience. In fact, even leading up to his time in Jerusalem, he was prophesying about, here's what the chief priests and elders are going to do to me. They're going to betray me, and so on and so forth. But I'm going to be raised from the dead. So he knew what was coming. He knew when and how he would die. In Luke chapter 22, being aware of that, he's praying before his arrest. And he's gathered, this is after that supper, he's gathered in the garden, and he asks some of the disciples with him. But notice in Luke chapter 22, that in verse 41, he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. So what's he praying? He's praying, God, I know what's about to happen. And I know what I'm about to experience. And I don't want to do this. I don't want to go through this thing. If it's possible, let me avoid it. But he says, I know. I know the answer to this prayer already. And your will is that I was sent here to make this sacrifice to redeem these people we love. And so I know what I have to do. But it doesn't take away the fact of the pain and the sacrifice involved in making this decision. And it says in verse 24 of Luke 22, being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Now, you've been stressed out. You've been in torment. You've been in fear. I have as well. And we've been in moments like that where we pray earnestly. We've all been there. But I don't think any of us have ever been under so much strain and pressure that we begin to excrete blood because of the pressure of the mental anguish we're going through. But that's what he's doing. That's how much agony this man is in, because he knew exactly what was about to happen. So he's aware of the death, of the sorrow, and the pain he's about to experience. But he presses on, and he says, not my will, but yours be done. We've got to do this to save these people, to have their sins passed over. And so he goes through with this. And again, this is just the initial stages. He's just beginning. That eventually he's arrested and he's beaten. These people are blindfolding him. They're slapping him, saying, okay, you great prophet, tell us who just hit you. If you know everything. Come on, you son of God. Come on, answer that question. If you know everything, who just hit you? Now he knew. But he surrendered and submitted and did not respond to their questions. But it didn't. He just kept up. And eventually in Mark chapter 15, it talks about the fact that he was beaten, and then, of course, he was stoned. In Mark chapter 15, it talks about in verse 15, so Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him to be crucified. Now, I read over that, and I'm like, yeah, okay, he was scourged and crucified. All right. Well, friends, that's big. That's tremendous. That Jesus would be scourged. Well, what's scourging? You know what scourging was? It was when they would take a whip and at the strands, tips of the strands, they would have bone or metal or something. And they would take a person and they would tie his arms around a rock or some type of boulder or something to tighten his back. And then they would take out this whip and they would whip this guy. And they would whip him with great precision and with great anger. And you know he's going through all this and all these lacerations are taking place, and I'm sure his face is turned aside. It's getting some of that as well. And it's being done by a professional soldier. I remember one year I was going to a meeting, traveling on Saturday, and the Masters is on the radio, the golf tournament. So I'm listening to this. And I've never done this. I like to watch it, but I never listened to a golf tournament. So I'm going down the road, and they have coverage of people at various places. And they had some coverage from the tee boxes. And I've never heard it like that before. You know, these professional golfers, and they're taking their swings, and it's just... Terry, you and I don't have a prayer if that happens. They don't, it's not even close to our little wimpy swing. It's nothing like that. These are professionals. I mean, it's just a... It's a sound like I never heard before. And when you think about the fact that Jesus is being whipped by professional soldiers, it's not like a bat. It's not that. I mean, this has some velocity to it. You know, some intensity to it. And Jesus is getting his back ripped open by these people. And then it says, after he was scourged, what happened? He was led away to be crucified. That's huge. The scourging would knock me out of the game. I would quit right there. I'm done with this. Even the threat of being scourged would probably knock me out. But Jesus endured that scourging, and then he endured crucifixion, which was designed to torment the person, humiliate the person, and to discourage other people from committing similar crimes. And he died like that. He came across something that was interesting, of a medical doctor trying to explain the physical description of crucifixion. But the cross is placed on the ground, and the exhausted man is quickly thrown backwards with his shoulders against the wood. The legionnaire feels for the depression at the front of the wrist. He drives a heavy square wrought iron nail through the wrist deep into the wood. Quickly he moves to the other side, repeats the action, being careful not to pull the arms too tightly, but to allow some flex and movement. The cross is then lifted into place. The left foot is pressed backward against the right, and with both feet extended down, or toes down, the nail is driven through the arch of each, leaving the knees flexed. The victim is now crucified. As he slowly sags down with more weight on the nails and the wrist, excruciating fiery pain shoots along the fingers and up the arms to explode in the brain. The nails and the wrist are putting pressure on the median nerves. As he pushes himself upward to avoid this stretching torment, he places the full weight on the nail through his feet. Again, he feels the searing agony of the nail tearing through the nerves between the bones of his feet. As the arms fatigue, cramps sweep through his muscles, knotting them with deep, relentless, throbbing pain. With these cramps comes the inability to push himself up to breathe. Air can be drawn into the lungs but not exhaled. He fights to raise himself in order to get even one small breath. Finally, carbon dioxide builds up in the lungs and the bloodstream, and the cramps partially subside. Spasmodically, he is able to push himself upward to exhale and bring in life-giving oxygen. Hours of limitless pain, cycles of twisting, joint-wrenching cramps, searing pain as tissue is torn from his lacerated back as he goes up and down the rope tippet. Then another agony begins. A deep, crushing pain deep in the chest as the pericardium slowly fills with serum and begins to compress the heart. It's now almost over. Loss of fluid, so on and so forth, as his heart is struggling to pump his sluggish blood. So this is happening. And he's hanging by the nails, he's pushing against the nail, he's going up and down this timber with his back all ripped open, and he's experiencing all types of pain. And what Jesus says is, I want you to think about, when you take that bread, I want you to think about the body I gave you. But there was a price for this. There was some pain involved in me providing you with this passage of sin. And as it says in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of it. Now think about that. Jesus couldn't come here and live like we do and simply die of a heart attack and pay for sin. He had to lay down his life to pay for sin. He had to take something of value and lay it down. He couldn't fall off a cart and get run over. He couldn't face a stroke and face it. He had to actually make a sacrifice of life to redeem us from sin. And he did this, of course, in the prime of his life. And so he is suffering death to provide us with redemption, that he might taste death for everyone. So that's what he wants us to think. Now, when we take the Lord's Supper, it's not time to think about what we're going to have for lunch. It's not time to think about our fantasy lineup or what bills need to be paid. It's time to think about Jesus. And specifically, we're to think about that body that was in so much pain and agony, and how he was going through all of this so that you and I could have hold past our rebellion and our weakness. And, of course, it's something that he wants done every Sunday. That when you look in the New Testament, it's the group of Christians who were told to take this. We understand it was given initially that Thursday night before he died with his disciples, but it wasn't taken anymore after that until Christianity began. And the very first day of Christianity, the day of Pentecost, was a Sunday. And it says in Acts chapter 2 that they were gathering to break bread. And to follow the apostles' doctrine, which again was new development for Jews, for them to follow something other than the law of Moses, but to take the Lord's Supper.
as soon as Christianity began.
It says in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, that Paul waited 7 days there to take the Lord's Supper with the disciples there at Troas. So he came in on a Monday, and he's traveling. And yet he waits all the way till Sunday to take the Lord's Supper with his people. And obviously he had places to go and things to do, but he waited because the Lord's Supper was only to be taken on the first day of the week with Christians. And so he waited there, and that's when they gathered to do this. And that's the language of the New Testament, the first day of the week. Well, how often does the first day occur? How many weeks have a first day? And so we understand that this is something that is frequent, and it's not too hard to comprehend, or it's not too hard for us to analyze this. If your boss said he was only going to pay you on the first day of the week, would you interpret that possibly as once a year? I mean, is there any way you would interpret that saying, okay, what does that mean? Does that mean once a month? Does that mean once a quarter? Does it mean once a year, once in a lifetime? No, we would understand if he said, I'm going to pay you on the first day of the week, you knew what to expect. Well, in the New Testament, we see the only time Christians gathered to take the Lord's Supper was to do this on the Sunday, this first day. And when you look in the Bible, that language is there by design. Because when God wanted his people to do something once a year, what did he tell them to do? Like the day of atonement. How did he word that? That they were to stop on what? He would pinpoint the day and the month, right? Well, I think it's the 10th day of the 7th month, if I'm not mistaken. The Day of Atonement. Somewhere in there. 10th day of the 7th month. So he would pinpoint the day of the month from the year. When he wanted something done once a month or monthly, what would he do? Like a new moon. Well, he would specify that period. But when he wanted something done on a weekly basis, what would happen? He'd specify the day of the week. Just like he did with the Sabbath. When he told them to remember the Sabbath day. Well, which Sabbath day? Every week it has a Sabbath. You're to remember the Sabbath is what he told you. And that's the language God uses in telling us to take the Lord's Supper. And so friends of ours who have interpreted this to mean once a year, once a quarter, whatever, they've misinterpreted the Bible. Because God is very specific in this. Paul waited 7 days to take it on a Sunday. And so obviously it was done with intent and with urgency, yes. But it was done with understanding. Knowing that this is the day Jesus wants us to pause and think about the sacrifice he made for us. And that this is how he wants us to do it. That it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that Jesus has not told us to take Easter or to practice Christmas or even the Eucharist, but instead he wants us to do this. And here's what Paul said. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23, beginning, I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. Now, who's speaking here? Right, Paul's speaking. And what's Paul saying? Well, Paul is correcting a lot of stuff there at Corinth, but he's also correcting how they took the Lord's Supper. Because what they thought was the Lord's Supper was not the Lord's Supper. And so he's having to instruct them on how to take the Lord's Supper. And here's what he says. I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. The night that Jesus was betrayed to bread, that's what we're supposed to do. Now here's the question. Was Paul in that room the night that Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper? Was he among the disciples when Jesus gathered to begin this memorial? Of course not. He wasn't even serving Christ at that time. So what does he mean by this? That I received from the Lord. Well, obviously he's talking about inspiration, right? And by inspiration, he's saying, look, we all go back to that room. Okay, we all go back to that night Jesus was betrayed. And we all go back and we think about the things that he started back then. Telling people to think about his body and to think about his blood. That when he was given thanks, he broke the bread and he said, take eat, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Alright, so Jesus, how do you want me to remember you? Well, friends tell me that I need to do this every year to think about his birth, or I need to do this every year to think about his resurrection, or some other type of memorial, and yet Jesus says, stretch all that. What I want you to think about is my death. And I want you to think about my sacrifice, and that this is how I want you to remember me. That if the birth was significant to his plan, he would have told us when he was born. Or even if the resurrection, in terms of memorial services, was important, he would have said that. But he said, go back to my death. Think about my death and think about my sacrifice for you. This is what he wants us to reflect on. And that this is not a meal that is designed to feed us physically. Now here's where it's a little different than the Passover. Because obviously the Passover was a meal that they would have together as Jews. And that was an actual physical meal that they nourished themselves with. Well, Jesus said this is not that. That after that meal, after the Passover, it says, then he took the emblems and he says, I want you to think about me by using these emblems. And it's not designed to feed our stomachs or to satisfy our hunger. In fact, going back to the Corinthian letter, it says that when Paul corrected these people, he says, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. Now, what he meant by that was, you guys think you're coming together for the Lord's Supper, but the way you're practicing it is not the way Jesus set it up. And so your idea of the Lord's Supper, what God thinks about the Lord's Supper, are two different things. You think it's the Lord's Supper. And what they were doing is they were gathering for a common meal, thinking that that's what God wanted. And Paul says, no, that's not what this is. It's not a common meal. This is not a potluck. Okay, that's not what this is. That if you want to do those things, what does he tell them to do? You go, you've got places to go home and do that. That's not the purpose of the church. It's to engage in these things. You have houses to do those things. And so he's correcting at least that concept and telling them where to practice those things. And of course, the other issues they had in failing to take the Lord's Supper properly. But what he did show them is that he wanted them to think about the spiritual aspect of this. And of course, the fruit of the vine being the blood of Christ and how it redeems us from sin. Now, notice how in Matthew 26, when Jesus gave the Lord's Supper, this is what he said. I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now that's what he said the night he was betrayed. We're doing this, but we're not going to do it again until in my Father's kingdom. And of course we understand that the Lord's Supper was not practiced for many times in the Bible from that Thursday night until Acts 2. And obviously Acts 2 is the foundation of the church. The church began in the kingdom of heaven. That's how the church is referred to in the Bible. And so there in Acts 2, the day of Pentecost, they're gathering. Alright, so they're resuming this memorial. They're practicing this memorial just like Jesus said would happen. But notice the language. That Jesus says that I will drink it new with you. I will drink it new with you. When we engage in the Lord's Supper, friends, we need to understand we are engaging in a spiritual meal with Jesus. Obviously not a physical meal, but a spiritual meal. That we are having communion with him. Paul told the Corinthians, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood? That you are having fellowship and sharing in this blood by taking these emblems. Again, it's not to satisfy your hunger. You have houses to do that stuff. Go somewhere else and do that. But the spiritual aspect, yeah, we need to think about that. And we need to think about the fact that we're taking this with Jesus. How often do we think about that? The fact that I'm having communion with him. That I'm interacting with him. I'm engaging with him. I'm one with him as I take these emblems and as I reflect on his sacrifice. It's incorrectly known by various terms in our society. And these are things that we cannot find in the New Testament in regard to the Lord's Supper. And so let us be mindful of that because we need to take this thing in the proper manner. We must take it respectfully. Again, when we take the Lord's Supper, it's not just something we we devour and just move on. He wants us to think about what we're actually engaging in. And so Paul told the Corinthians, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. Now obviously, we need to Notice the language there. Because he says, unworthy men. Sometimes people wonder, well, you know, if I sin too much, am I too unworthy to take the Lord's Supper? You know, there are people that wonder that. I've just done too much evil this past week for me to be worthy to take the Lord's Supper. Well, I can tell you right now, none of us is ever worthy of it. None of us is ever worthy or deserving of the sacrifice. And so Paul's not correcting that. What he's saying is you need to take it in a manner that is worthy. Because when you don't do this right, you're guilty of killing Jesus. Or at least you're guilty of the sins that led to Jesus being killed. You're guilty of the body and blood of Jesus. That's what he's pointing out. Now, when I think about that, that's where it really begins to get my attention that I need to do this properly. You know, if we go and we fail to remember the 4th of July, or we fail to remember Thanksgiving, or we fail to pause in life to go and think about some type of memorial set up. I mean, yes, it can reflect on our mentality as citizens of this nation. You know, and that can obviously diminish our patriotism and things like that. That can happen to us. We always need to be grateful for the people who sacrificed to give us our liberty. But in failing to engage in those memorials, we haven't sinned. We may have harmed ourselves as citizens of this nation, but we haven't sinned, right? Well, what God is telling us here is that when we don't take this in a worthy manner, it's not like missing the 4th of July. That there's a whole different thing going on here. And what he's saying is that when you and I just simply break this and sip this and say, okay, what's next? We've sinned. Right? But is that not what he's saying here? That whenever we don't take this properly, we are guilty of something. Well, you know what? I don't see that with 4th of July. I don't see him telling me, okay, if you don't get up and think about what this day means to your nation, you sin. No. This is totally different from any other memorial service. This is special. Because Jesus, yes, other people have died to give us these liberties, but Jesus has made the ultimate sacrifice of all that pain and agony. And really, what we need to think about also is the fact that when he was on the cross, you had hours of darkness across the land. Well, what's that reflecting? Obviously, it's reflecting the separation that he and the Father were experiencing. And that this was so painful for Jesus to become sin for us, to be separated from his Father, that nature even reflected that pain. And then agony. So I need to think about that. I need to be mindful of that. And I need to see the love, really, the love that he has for me in going through. I close with this question here. Because people say, well, you know, if we take this every Sunday, it's going to lose its value, it's going to lose its meaning. And so we only need to take it once a year. And yet we still sing, right? We still pray every service. And we still give on the first day of the week, and somehow that still has meaning. So, don't, if this loses its meaning every week, then the problem is not the memorial, the problem is us, right? We need to change our heart and our thinking. Frankly, if we're what we're supposed to be, and if we're truly grateful for Jesus, we'll think about it every day, throughout the day, of the sacrifice he made for us. But in terms of engaging in memorial service, then yeah, we only do it once a week as it tells us. But for people who say, no, I don't want to do that, what's odd to me is churches that teach that, they still assemble on Sunday. They still seek Sunday as the Lord's Day. And my question is why? Why that day? Why not make Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday? Why Sunday? Why is Sunday the Lord's Day? Even if you don't take the Lord's Supper. And what they fail to realize is Sunday is the Lord's Day because it was initiated by the New Testament. That this is the day saints gather to take the Lord's Supper. That's why this day is special. But if we gather and we don't do this, we don't take the Lord's Supper, we instead want to say, okay, once a year is good enough. Why are we still assembling? And why do we still see the need to assemble? So, you know, I had a different sermon obviously prepared, but this morning I just felt like this one instead. And I hope it's going to help you some, especially when we take the Lord's Supper here after a while. But Jesus went through so much for us. And I need to think of that. I need to be grateful for that. And I think, obviously, these are thoughts that are worthy of us considering. I know this is a class, so I guess I'll open the floor to any questions or comments just this one time. The rest of the week, you've got to just sit there. But any comments or questions about the Lord's Supper or the things we looked at or things we didn't look at? Anything you want to add to this?
Okay,
no, here's the short answer.
I know the situation was actually calm, but it's not here.
Yeah. Well, I would discourage that. You know, because this
well, of course, but what do you say?
All right. Well, give me your chance. I'm about to answer. Right. Right. But you're talking about in the assembly, right? You're talking about when the trays are being passed, just taking it as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
I look at the line up around this one,
right? Because
I know the kids don't get the food that they need to do it, right? But what's the best way to do it?
Well, I'm not going to drag them out of the pew, right? If it happens and say, no, we're not doing this. But obviously, I would try and talk to the parent. Here's the short answer. The people who were told to take the Lord's Supper, the disciples, right? That's the answer. That the disciples are the ones who were told. Sometimes people wonder, well, what about our visitors? Because it's the same principle. You know, should we let the visitors take the Lord's Supper? Well, that's between them and God, but it won't do them any good, right? Until they're in that same relationship. It won't benefit them. That what God wants more than anything is for us to be saved from sin. And so that would be the first thing. But, you know, the people who are not Christians, they just need to be taught that this is not for just anybody. It's for the disciples. Did I see a hand there? I used to love it when my mom came in. I would. I'd get the leftovers when she was cleaning the tray. Yeah. I mean, because it's already served its purpose. Now, I did need a lady in the line that said, no, you can't do that because this stuff is, you know, it's been sanctified and holy and things like that. But obviously, it's already served its purpose at that point of being a memorial. Emblems for the Lord. So, yes, Tom.
Should we let the visitors take? We don't let anybody take it, right? Each person decides for themselves. It's not like if I'm passing the bread, I'm going to miss someone on purpose.
Exactly.
Because I don't think they should take it.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's between them and God. Obviously.
We don't let anybody.
Okay.
Or don't right. Not let anybody.
Right. I mean, it is. It's open in that sense. It's not a closed communion. It's sometimes considered.
An example of an unworthy man.
Well, take it and not think about it. Right? That would be, I mean, I've done that. You know, it's not right. It's wrong. It needs to be repented of. Ask it.